Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I've got a few charts today, so this is a new departure for my lecturing style, so I've got to make these various machines work. Can I start this lecture with just a couple of little vignettes? I was lucky enough to be in Berlin in November 1989 when the Berlin Wall was opened up. And a couple of things that happened there stuck in my mind ever since. I mean, of course, the event itself stuck in my mind because it was the transition of modern world history, really, the Berlin Wall being the physical marker, really, of the division of a bipolar society. But a couple of more minor things stuck in my mind, one of which is not really relevant to this lecture, but the other is. The first was, I don't know how many people here, perhaps not many, ever went to East Berlin when the wall existed. But it was a pretty unnerving experience. And just before, a couple of days before, the wall was actually opened, I went through into East Berlin. And the guards, you know, the East German border guards were just horrible. I don't know anyone has experienced this. They look so hostile, menacing. They wouldn't smile at anybody. They were pulling people to one side. They were as bureaucratic as you could get. They were the official arm of the state, and you could see it imprinted on their faces. When the wall was open, we went back through into East Berlin, and the difference was just completely amazing. Instead of these brutish people, who after all did have this brutal history too, as border guards, they were smiling, they just talked to people going through, they seemed like everybody else. I'd never seen such a change, I don't think in my life really, of like two different personalities. It was like schizophrenic experience really. And you have to ask yourself, which was the authentic person? I mean, I presume the second personality was the authentic personality of these individuals, but it struck me as something about the power of the state, you know, embodied in the physical form of the body, in the kind of brutality and the brutal outlook of officials in those sorts of positions. And I know that's stuck with me ever since. That's not especially relevant to this lecture, but the second thing is more. You might not realize it, but here you're looking at one of the first people to clamber up on the wall, because it was my main claim to fame, because we were told that the wall was going to be opened, and a group of us at a seminar got down there almost before anyone else in the city, really. And this other thing happened, which I've been thinking about ever since, really. We were trying, it was obvious you could get up on the wall. There were ladders being put up on the wall, so people began to try and climb up. But we were stopped from climbing up by the TV crews, who said, "You mustn't climb the ladders until we get the cameras up there so we can film you climbing the ladders, so we can see you making history." Now, there's something really interesting in that, I think, beyond the kind of slightly comic aspect of it. We did, in fact, get up on the wall very quickly, so we were among the first, and we were among the first to be televised on the wall. But there's something about the role of communications and media in democratization, which is part of my theme today, involved in that little story, I think. Because television, in this instance, is no longer plainly, I think, just recording history. Television and other media of communication are not just ways of describing, representing, visualizing things. They've become constitutively bound up with what history is. Part of the history of these changes is the history of communications, I think. And I think there are very few people now who doubt the impact of television, for instance, in the more general events in Eastern Europe in 1989 and after. Have more to say about that subsequently. The main theme of my lecture is democratization, and the main questions I want to ask and try to answer in this 50 or so minutes is what accounts for the dramatic spread of democratization across the world over the past 10 to 15 years, or maybe 20 years, of which the transitions in 1989 are one, but only one example. The reason I bought some materials is that you can actually document, I think, relatively easily how significant the global spread of democracy is. I should point out under this first question, to some extent one's talking about two things: the long-term development of the democratic idea, because although everyone is a democrat now, this has certainly not been true for most of the past 200 years. Democracy was an alien idea to most people in most countries, especially in elite groups throughout the world, until relatively recently, certainly until the early years of the 20th century. Democracy is one of the world-conquering ideas, but this conquest is relatively recent and has been a very radical spread of this over this past period I mentioned. Therefore, you suspect, and I think it to be the case, that the more recent spread of democratization across the world is bound up with the other changes I'm analyzing in these lectures. It is an expression of them, I think, and an expression of the problematic nature of them as well. It's not just a benign process, it's one fraught with difficulties. So the first question is what accounts for particularly the recent dramatic spread of democratic institutions. Second question is, where does this leave us? Because there are undeniably problems with democracy. Everybody wants to be a democrat. There is virtually no political leader in the world. There are a few, but not many, who don't declare themselves to be democrats. Democracy may be the idea of the age, political idea of the age, but there are big problems right at the core of democratic institutions, which we have to also take a look at. Now, I'm holding this blue document here because it just came through the post this morning, so I thought I'd bring it along. It's just because it sort of expressed to me the fact that democracy has now become such a universal idea, global idea. It's produced by an organization called Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, which has been sponsored or is organized by 14 different countries in the world. And the blurb for it is a blurb, but it also describes a reality. It says the world is entering into an age of democracy. Democratic values are becoming more and more widely accepted. Issues of governance are high on national and international agendas. And in recent years, there's been an upsurge in the number of elections worldwide. All true, as I'll demonstrate in a minute. There is now, it says, a window of opportunity and hope for democracy, perhaps a unique moment in history to be seized. Then you turn the page, if I can turn the page, using only one finger, and you come across the nations which are supporting this initiative. It's very interesting. They include Chile. Chile has a background of authoritarian government. It has a longer term, of course, history of democracy, but a recent background of military rule. It includes Namibia, which labored under South African apartheid until about 1990 or so. It includes Portugal, which up until a quarter of a century ago also had a right-wing authoritarian government. It includes Spain, of which the same was true. And it includes South Africa itself, which right up until only 3 or 4 years ago labored under the highly authoritarian regime of apartheid itself. Out of this list then of 14 countries, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 with recent histories of authoritarian rule. The fact that they're all now included within a democratic panoply of nations is already an indication of changes happening in the world. Let's therefore look at these things a bit more systematically, if I can make these machines work, which is sort of dubious. This table here just describes the measures used in a recent study to try and chart democratization processes worldwide. And it essentially charts out a movement from a predominance of societies in the authoritarian. Can you actually see that? I don't know how to make it better. Is that better? Not very well here. Maybe it's the wrong way up. It's the one on the right. It's hard to read, isn't it? How do you do it? Move it. More, which way? I knew I shouldn't have embarked on this blooming thing with tables and things. Oh, I see there's something. I've got to switch this one off, I think, somewhere. We'll get that one out of the way. Oh, well. I can see this isn't going to work too well. Is there anyone who can give technical assistance? You think it's better like that, you mean? It won't go on this, will it? What? No, it won't work on that. Will that work on that? I think I have to give up and go back to this one. If you can't read it, it doesn't matter that much. On the left-hand side, anyway, there's a... I've got to try and make the next one work. There is a table which basically sums up the characteristics of liberal democracy. What is liberal democracy? Well, liberal democracy is a democratic system which involves more than one political party, where those political parties compete for governance, where there are free and fair elections. Maybe you're supposed to write on that thing, are you? Where there are effective civil and political rights and where it is possible for people freely to enter into associations with one another, whether these be little political parties or other kinds of civil associations. There is a free realm of civil society. On the other side, the right-hand side, authoritarian states in this study are designated as states essentially where you could write a negative against all of these characteristics, where there is a government which is not accountable through elections, where there may be no competitive elections at all, where there are restrictions on human rights and political rights, and where there is an attempt to stop autonomous association in civil society. The middle category is simply regimes which are making a transition from one to the other. Now, how am I going to manage this? I must be doing something completely wrong here, I suppose. It won't work on this one, will it? Thank you. White paper on top of. Ah, well done. Thank you. Well, that's brilliant. I have to give you a prize later.
You can't do that. I'm afraid the font on these are a bit too small.
Really?
Well, can you do it some other way? What about on that one? Will it work on that one then? Well, I'm afraid this marks the end of my experiment with technology. And I'll leave it up there in case you can see it. Is that better than nothing?
Might just need to move.
feet.
All right, let's just leave it there.
Well, this isn't working too well. I'm going to have to go back to my old system. I'm going to have to get Narius to train me in teaching techniques, I think, really. Let me just go through this verbally in case it's... Oh, it's fairly clear on there, isn't it, actually? What the table traces out and describes actually very graphically, if you accept the measures used, is the massive scale of transition over the past 20 or so years across the world from authoritarian forms of government to democratic forms of government, to liberal democracy. And you can trace that out by comparing the table on the right-hand side here with that table on the right-hand side there to see how these changes have happened. In Western Europe, the two countries which have become democratic countries are the ones I mentioned, Portugal and Spain, over that period. Latin America, you have big movement, 5 to 15 liberal democracies. Asia, smaller but still significant movement, big movement in sub-Saharan Africa, and so it goes on down the list until you reach the totals at the bottom, which you can see the proportion of countries in the world by these measures anyway, which have liberal democratic institutions, goes up from 23 or 24% in 1975 up to nearly 50% in 1995, would be about 50% 1998, I think, if you carried this study forward, which marks really a massive change in the global society. There's also a pretty strong movement in the middle, the partial democratic category two. So these figures, insofar as I've managed to actually convey them to you through these sort of failures of technology, do, I think, provide a very straightforward and clear statement of what is a global revolution in process. You're talking about, of course, a global revolution of capitalist markets. You're also talking of a global revolution of democracy. And we have to ask what it adds up to, and what are the motive forces behind this process. Now, I want to suggest to you there are two interpretations you could give of the reasons underlying the spread of democratization across the world. Each of these, I think, have been linked to the 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe, but I think apply also much more widely. The first theory, let me call the conventional theory. As you suspect from that, it's the one that I want to reject, or at least say I have reservations about. The conventional theory, the spread of democracy, you could call a social lag theory. That theory suggests that certain kinds of states and certain kinds of economies lag behind the more developed ones, and that the process of democratization can therefore be understood as a sort of catching up process. According to this theory, for example, if you looked at the East European countries and the Soviet Union prior to 1989, these were essentially non-democratic countries with only a relatively modest level of economic development. They were simply lagging behind the Western liberal democracies, both in terms of their economies, which were closed rather than market economies, and in terms of their governments, which were authoritarian rather than democratic. Now, according to the lag theory, or the conventional theory, the problem of democratization making a transition from authoritarian forms of government to democratic ones is simply a problem of catching up with the institutions of the West. So that if you consider the ex-socialist countries, the ex-communist countries, their problems are twofold: how to introduce a market economy on the one hand, and how to copy the liberal democratic multi-party institutions of the West on the other. A fairly simple account, I think, of what's going on here. The conventional theory tends to be also what I'll call perhaps to fix it in your minds a bit, the fragile flower theory of democracy. Democracy, according to this view, is a fragile flower because you need very rich historical and cultural soil in which to grow it. According to this type of theory, it takes a long time to catch up, because in Western countries you have a well-established culture of civic rights, of human rights, of party systems, a whole cultural apparatus of democracy, which has taken a long time to establish. According to this view, countries which are making a transition to democracy are going to find it very hard to achieve, because it's not something you can do in the short term. Therefore, this theory would say, if you look at the case of Russia, for example, there is no clear transition to effective democratic mechanisms. You seem to have a society, I'm not endorsing this, but you seem to have a society, this view says, which is kind of mafia-style capitalism or Chicago-style capitalism, coupled to a sort of leadership democracy in which there is not really an effective party system, where there is still corruption at the top, and where sort of analogous mechanisms really to the power of elites in the communist Soviet Union still to some extent persist. This whole view then, I'm calling the conventional view of democratization. The process of democratization across the world, according to this view, would be a process of societies seeing or being forced to see that they need to catch up with the Western model, which both in terms of its economic market society and in terms of its governmental mechanisms is simply ahead of the more authoritarian regimes. Now, I don't think this theory is an effective one. It's not, of course, wholly wrong, but it's not effective precisely because it doesn't explain the nature of the statistics I ineffectively tried to put on the board just now. It doesn't explain why there should be a surge forward across the world in the expansion of democratic regimes. And as an explanation, if it is one, of the collapse of the power of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union and Soviet-style societies, it's a pretty inept theory. Because here you have one of the most dramatic transitions in history, but accomplished in virtually a bloodless fashion. That the revolutions of 1989 were not revolutions like other revolutions, in the sense in which there was very little violence, apart from Romania, and there were what seemed to be completely established power systems represented in the face of the guards I saw in East Berlin. These looked like monolithic power systems that were there to stay for 100 years, and yet they sort of vanished overnight. There's something crucial to explain here. I'd therefore like to propose to you a second theory of democratization, which links the changes associated with the spread of democracy across the world with the wider changes now transforming world society. And again, to sort of stick it in your mind, I'd like to call this the sturdy plant theory of democracy. Rather than democracy being a fragile flower, which is always likely to die, which has to be cultivated all the time, I think the structural changes going on in world society are making democratization a much more sturdy, much more immediate and powerful phenomenon than the previous theory suggests. The sturdy plant theory of democracy would suggest that democratization is taking root everywhere, that it can grow on hitherto what might appear to be infertile soil. And it also suggests, one of the key things I'd like to suggest, is that if you understand the true reasons for the spread of democratization, you can also see and understand a key phenomenon of our times, that this is the age of democracy on the one hand, yet at the same time, democracy where this means liberal democratic institutions is under immense strain. Liberal democracy is, at least in some respects, failing at the very point of its apparent world historical success. You can't explain that, I think, by the conventional theory. You have to see that the very processes that are producing a trend towards liberal democratic institutions across the world, at the same time, to some degree, are subverting those institutions. The very processes which underlie the coming into prominence of democracy, at the same time, are undercutting the power and the sufficiency of liberal democratic institutions in the Western countries themselves, not just across the newly democratizing world. We must look at the problems which liberal democracy faces as part and parcel of the same processes. What are these processes? Well, I feel I can go through them fairly briefly because they are the themes of these lectures as a whole. I've tried to argue through these lectures there are a series of very profound structural transformations affecting world society at the same time as they are affecting our everyday lives. The transformation of everyday life goes along with the transformation of the global society and is causally involved with it. There are three aspects of these changes I'd just like to re-emphasize again because they're also relevant to the next lecture next week on personal life, the emotions, sexuality and the body. First, the thing I've talked about a lot, the impact of globalization. Here you have to see and make sense of globalization not as the global marketplace primarily, but as the impact of global communication systems, especially the impact of electronic communication. I've tried to stress all the way through these lectures that what used to be, as Geoffrey and I were talking just before this lecture, a term that hardly anyone used 10 years ago, globalization now is used all the time, it's become sort of denuded of meaning, if you like, but usually when people use it, they do mean, I think, the intensification of a global marketplace. It means far more than that. It means the emergence of what I've called a global cosmopolitan society, in which instantaneous communications, especially electronic communications, play a new role. Now, I think the role of electronic communications, especially television, as I mentioned right at the beginning, if you generalize this point, is crucial to the spread of democratization across the world today. It was crucial to the events of 1989 and their aftermath. 1989 could not have happened in the way it did without the kind of dialogic involvement which television produced, which each event produced a subsequent event which was linked to another event. Of course, other forces were involved too, but there's something like a global dialogue going on, mediated electronically. A dialogue, for example, between people in proximate countries. There was a dialogue, I think, between Hungary and East Germany, for example, mediated through television representation of crowds on the streets. But I think there was a subsequent dialogue stretching through to South Africa, to the Middle East, and probably even to Northern Ireland. That is, all of these peace processes, transformation processes, however successful or otherwise they might turn out to be, are a kind of dialogical reflection upon a previous set of televisual events. One of the things that brought this home to me was one of the aborted democratic revolutions of this time in Tiananmen Square, where there was a picture which you can see, which was not available immediately, but very quickly in the West, of someone holding a placard in Tiananmen Square, which actually was a response to a placard, something written on a placard that someone had been holding in the events in the Prague Velvet Revolution. And if you notice this, you see this happening again and again in televisual displays of crowd power, a kind of visual dialogue, almost conscious, I think largely conscious dialogue really, going on. This is a new type of society, I think, where these events happen. And the fact that the 1989 revolutions were televisual revolutions is one major factor, I think, explaining the lack of violence in them. Dialogue, to some degree, you could argue, crudely put, did replace violence. A lot more could be said about that. Second, the second major factor underlying the spread of democratization is the global fate of tradition and custom in our times. I've tried to argue in earlier lectures that we're living in a global culture of radical detraditionalization, where the role of tradition simply does not play the part in people's lives that it used to do. With many exceptions, many countries and many segments which still remain quite traditional. Overall, tradition and custom do not play the same role as they used to do. What is tradition? Well, tradition is a way of linking the past to the future. Tradition is about time. I talked last lecture about risk and trust. They're about time. Well, tradition is also about time. Tradition is a way in which you make the past live in the future, and you define the present primarily through the past. Traditions are not static, but by definition, they apply repetitive processes and rituals to the organization of future time. Tradition in that sense is becoming supplanted by a global information order. A global information order lives out of time. It lives in news time. News time is so different from historical time. Anyone who follows any event in the news, such as the current travails of President Clinton, can see what news time is. But the idea of the news, especially globally carried electronic news, it is immediate. It is only news because it is today's news. It is a dialogic relationship to previous news. It is a new kind of reality, if you like, mediated by television. And I would imagine the pictures of Hillary Clinton on television, which I saw in The Guardian this morning, probably in all other newspapers almost across the world, I would guess. You see more or less the same images. This is a very, very different informational culture. Third, as a result of this, we're living in a much more reflexive world. The idea of reflexivity, I think, is crucial to the changes occurring in the world. A more reflexive society is not a society where people are more self-conscious than before. It's a society where you constantly have to make use of information, incoming information, new information, to organize what you do in relation to yourself, in relation to projects you take up, and in relation to collective institutions of which we form a part. A reflexive society is one in which you cannot live apart from taking a position in relation to a whole variety of incoming information sources. A reflexive society is therefore, as I've sometimes called it, a society of clever people. It doesn't mean that people are more clever than they used to be. It means that when you have a reflexive citizenry, everybody lives in much the same information environment. Of course, there are stratifying factors, so access to information is heavily stratified by social class and by socioeconomic inequality. But by and large, in general, the trend is towards an open information environment in which, for example, governments and the citizenry share much the same information system. And this information system, you should recognize, I think, is constituted as it goes along. The whole point about reflexivity is it's not just reflection on a world, rather like the case of the TV crew I mentioned in the beginning, it constitutes the world as we go along. Let me give an example of that. If you listen to the Today program on the radio, I don't know how many people do, it's on quite early, starts about 6:30 and goes on till 9:00. Very, very influential in British society, British politics. The Today program purports to be a program which reports the news, and of course it does. But the Today program also makes the news. And you can see this by the very structure of the program. So, for example, a politician, say Tony Blair, will come on this program. He will say something about, say, welfare state reform. What he said about welfare state reform then becomes the news in the subsequent quarter of an hour of the Today program. So the Today presenter will say, describing the recent news, Tony Blair said on this program this morning, da-da-da, about the reform of the welfare state. Television, therefore, increasingly constitutes what the news is. It is not just reportage upon the news, but it is thereby only a generalization of what it's like to live increasingly in an information society where information is not just a means of describing the world around us, it constitutes what that world is. In this society, there is no choice but to be a reflexive citizen. This changes the nature of politics, it changes the nature of government, and the most clear-cut case of it, actually, is financial markets. Financial markets, as George Soros, the arch-speculator, ex-LSE student, has quite aptly remarked, are reflexive in the highest degree. Because in financial markets, which are televisual markets, instantaneous communication, 24-hour across the world, everybody is in possession of the same information. They know that everybody else is in possession of the same information as they are. They know that when they try to guess what other people are doing, other speculators are doing, those other people are guessing what their guesses are about their own guesses. That is the sort of height of reflexivity. But it drives the world economy now. You're not just talking about an immaterial world here. You're talking about a world which is settling our fate at this very moment. I want to suggest to you that in a more reflexive world, marked by the impact of globalization, in which the consequences of electronic communication are so strong, in that kind of world, you cannot live with the old structures of legitimacy and authority, or those structures come under radical strain. In a more reflexive, engaged sort of world, depending upon open information systems, the old bureaucratic systems start to collapse. I mean, Max Weber argued that bureaucracy was the most efficient kind of organization. Everybody thought that up until the mid-1970s. The most successful companies were the big bureaucratic large corporations. Now we're in a world where flexibility, smallness of size, bottom-up decision-making are not just ideologies, to some extent they are realities. They are the mode in which we live in a more reflexive world. More reflexive world necessarily tends to involve a more empowered citizenry. A more empowered citizenry itself stands behind global democratization processes. So you can say, of course, the spread of the capitalist market stands behind global democratization. It does. But it stands behind it because it also promotes these other forces. From this, I think you can therefore draw a number of conclusions about the future of democracy and the strains to which democracy is subject. Because although democracy has spread across the world, as I mentioned at the beginning, in all liberal democratic societies, I think without exception, there are signs of the strains inherent in liberal democratic institutions. If you look at measures of trust in government, for example, there are only one or two exceptions here in Europe anyway. In almost all European countries, the United States, a radical decline in levels of trust in government over the past 20 or so years. Also, decline in trust in other authority institutions, like the church, the police, and so forth. If you look at levels of voting, this is not true across all countries, but in many countries, there seems to be a fairly steep rise in voter apathy, especially marked by exclusionary processes whereby a substantial minority of people don't vote at all. And where if you look at surveys, especially among younger people, they say politics is uninteresting to them. The younger generation in Europe and the United States, by and large, declares itself to be uninterested in orthodox liberal democratic politics. What follows from this? Well, very briefly, let me list just a number of points about the future of democracy against this scenario. First, one must support what I call the conventional theory to some degree. That is, there are still many countries in the world in which it's crucial to attempt to institutionalize liberal democracy. However, I think at least in some cases, it may be easier to do this than conventional theory suggests. If democracy is not such a fragile flower, it might be possible to plant it much more effectively than many people imagine. And I think you can see good reasons for this. There are cases in history where there's been a movement from an authoritarian to a democratic system almost instantaneously. The two main cases involve the intervention of foreign powers. They are Japan after the Second World War and Germany after the Second World War, where democratic institutions were more or less forcibly established by the Americans. But those democratic institutions took root. If you consider Eastern Europe, I think you could say, it's perhaps surprising, but it is the case, the East European countries have very rapidly gone back to the pre-established traditions of liberal democracy, which many of them had. And I think, possibly, the future for Russia looks more optimistic than the critics would say. I think it's possible that there could be the establishment, in quite short order, of effective democratic mechanisms in Russian society, although, of course, only time will tell. Second, you cannot restrict discussion of the future of democracy to national democracy. We now live in a globalized order marked by these characteristics that I have suggested. We are therefore looking, I think, for the emergence of something like a cosmopolitan democracy, that the sociologist David Held, H-E-L-D, calls cosmopolitan democracy across the world. Cosmopolitan democracy must track globalization. Democratic mechanisms, which are limited to the national sphere, will not, of course, wholly track democratization. Now, I mentioned to you previously, when discussing globalization, that it pushes upwards and also pushes downwards. It takes power away from the nation state, at the same time it pushes towards more local autonomy for regions, cities, and so forth. Democratization, I think, now must track both of these processes. Therefore, democratization will be linked to increasing decentralization, the accentuation of local democratic mechanisms. The principle of subsidiarity in the European Union is not just ideological. It makes sense to do everything you can at the lowest possible level where that can be done effectively, i.e. take it out of the hands of the centralized state. On the other hand, democracy must also move upwards. You have to see the European Union now as a response to globalization. One aspect of the response has to be the European Union as an avenue of democratization above the level of the nation state, but still linked through the mechanisms of the nation state. Third, democratic mechanisms must link up with the major forces now moving people's lives. These forces often operate below the level of the nation state. The German sociologist, who's now going to be part of the LSE, part of the year, Ulrich Beck, I recommend you coming to hear him. He's going to give a public lecture in March. Calls this the realm of subpolitics. The realm of subpolitics refers to reflexively organized special interest and self-help groups. What you're seeing in our society is not a politically inactive society. Quite the opposite of what you imagine from findings that show people are uninterested in orthodox politics. Many of them are interested in orthodox politics, but they're very interested in unorthodox politics. The biggest phenomenon of the last 20 or so years, fantastic growth of self-help groups and special interest groups like animal rights groups, ecological groups, human rights groups, local associations, even including self-help groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and so forth. Most of these groups are local global associations. They are not limited to the sphere of the nation state. And orthodox democratic mechanisms must interact with them. Now, what one must see, I think, is that the role of special interest groups cannot replace democratic mechanisms. Because democratic mechanisms always have to reconcile different interests. Special interest groups fight for a particular interest, whether it's women's rights or it's ecological rights or whatever. We will still need democratic mechanisms, but they must interact with the increasingly reflexive, self-organized nature of world society if democracy is to be effective. Finally, this means considering other models of democracy than liberal democracy itself. Liberal democratic institutions, multi-party systems, orthodox party politics will still be necessary. But we do live in a world, I think, where experimentation with other democratic forms is not only possible but necessary. These forms of experimentation are going on all around us. They include, for example, possibilities of electronic democracy. There is a spread of referendum mechanisms throughout most Western societies, for example. These can be more easily organized, often through electronic means. There is a spread of return to local democracy, even direct democracy, in local associations, which could be integrated with national democracy. There are experiments like citizens' juries, in which people come together to debate a particular issue, and the results of that debate are fed into processes of government. There have been citizens' juries on television, for example, in this country about crime, capital punishment, and so forth. Out of all this, the final thing in all this is something I'm going to talk about in the lecture next time, which is democratization cannot be held to the public sphere. It is not limited. It's not just not limited to the sphere of orthodox parliamentary politics. It's not limited in its impact on the world to the public sphere alone. What we're seeing in personal life, what we're seeing in sexuality, gender relationships, is the spread of democratization there too. We need, I feel, to promote what in the next lecture I call a democracy of the emotions, democratization of personal life, as equally important in the contemporary world to the democratization of public institutions, and I'll be moving on to that in the lecture next time. And again, I do apologize for my problems with technology. Thanks very much.